Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who... I've changed it from a podcast to the podcast for people who want to keep up with the headlines, but who are not politics experts. There's no expectation on you to know anything. I say it at the beginning of every episode, but if you just want someone to strip back what's going on and make it make sense, finally... Then this is your podcast. I'm Julia Bell, and today I want to give you a run through of some of the big things that happened at the G7 summit in Cornwall over the weekend. I realise I'm slightly late on the train on this, but so much happened. I needed to collect everything that happened and put it in one place. So I have a feeling this will still be very, very useful. For those of you who missed, I've done an episode before on the G7 and I kind of explained it there, but just for those of you who missed it, the G7 member states are America, the UK, Germany, France, Canada, Italy, and Japan. And those leaders talked through some big topics in Cornwall. Donating vaccines to poor countries was one. But, you know, the question is, are they donating enough? How's it going to work? What's the actual timeline on it? Can they do it? We will run through that because that's a big topic. And then I can't believe I have to say this, but Brexit cropped its big ugly head back up constantly. Throughout the weekend, even though Boris Johnson said it was a vanishingly small topic, it wasn't. It constantly kind of created tensions, which I was quite surprised by. Maybe that's naive of me. I thought the big talking point other than COVID and the climate would be China and the threat, in inverted commas, that China poses as a superpower. And I thought the whole weekend would be dominated by conversations about, you know, how do we dampen China's global influence? But instead, we're talking about fucking Brexit. specifically, though, and it is serious, I laugh, but it's actually serious. It was talking about Northern Ireland and the issue and the tensions around our agreement on that and whether we're really sticking to it, which I will go through in lots of detail for you so you're really cleared up on it. But Joe Biden, actually, the American president, he proved to have a vested interest in that. So it didn't just involve the UK and the EU leaders, the US weighed in as well. So I'll break down that whole thing for you when we get into it, because there's lots of layers to it. And then I mentioned we wanted them to talk about the climate. This was something I had hoped, and I think a lot of you would have hoped, that would feature prominently in conversation. This is the first big summit between these leaders. It's Joe Biden's first international trip at all since he became president, because, of course, he became president in January was when he was inaugurated. And then since then, he's been dealing with a pandemic. So you'd think that the leaders would have to talk about the crisis that is on the cusp, isn't it? But I was relatively disappointed by how infrequently I saw it mentioned, particularly in the headlines. I was kind of trolling around trying to find the climate being mentioned, and it was usually either in a little box on the side of the newspaper or it just didn't make the front page at all. But even so, they made some pledges and we will unpack those. A few of you have been reaching out on Instagram and asking, what is the point of this G7 thing? Is it even that meaningful, or is it just like a photo op for all of the leaders and their other halves? I have some thoughts on that, and I'll hit you with ideas about that as well. So there's a lot to cover today. If you find this podcast helpful, you know what to do. Hit subscribe or hit follow if you're listening on Spotify. And if you have a question that you'd like me to answer on the podcast in future, then the only way to do that is to follow me on social media at @JuliaBell_X on Twitter and Instagram. No more faff. Let's get into it. I said at the start, I've done a podcast already about the G7, but it wasn't the leaders, it was the finance ministers that I covered. So their meeting, which is where Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, i.e. the man in charge of all the money in the UK, he hosted his equivalents in all the other G7 member states, so all the other finance ministers, he hosted them in London a week or so ago. And that was their own independent party, if you like, where they came up with lots of new policies and projects. And the key one was this plan to essentially try and get big tech companies to pay their fair share of taxes, which how many people are going to disagree with that? I don't think there will be many outside of the sort of top brass of the actual tech companies. I think everyone else will be thinking, yes, that sounds great. So if you want to listen to that episode, it is, of course, available. But this episode is covering the G7 Leaders Summit. So instead of Rishi Sunak, it's Boris Johnson that hosted everybody, and it was in Cornwall. And that's what happened over the weekend. The G7, I said it before, but it stands for the Group of Seven. And like I said last time, it's a club for wealthy democracies. That is basically the entrance criteria to get into this club. You don't just have to be a rich country. It's not a list of the richest countries in the world, because then, of course, China would be a front and central member, and it would knock the likes of the UK and France completely out of the picture. But China is absolutely not a democracy. So you have to have a bit of both in order to be a G7 member. I said also in the last podcast that Russia used to be a member, and then it got booted out because the other members of the G7 did not approve of Russia's actions when it annexed Crimea. So it got booted out. So there's a few criteria: being rich and being a democracy and having the other members approve of what you're up to on an international scale. They're the main things that you have to do. And incidentally, this G7 summit was Joe Biden's first international trip as president of the United States. So as you can imagine, our guys in the UK were overjoyed. Overjoyed. How good does this make us look? The fact that we happen to be hosting it this year and it's Joe Biden's first trip abroad and it's on our shores. It just was a big opportunity for us. And I think the UK government will have been very keen not to squander that and to get as many photos of everyone smiling and having a great time as possible. Make it look like we're best pals. And ahead of the main summit, Biden met with Boris Johnson in person and their wives met, and there was lots of photos of them strolling along the beach. You've probably seen the ones of like Carrie Simmons, now of course referred to as Mrs. Carrie Johnson, Boris Johnson's new wife, and Boris Johnson and Joe Biden and his wife Jill Biden strolling along barefoot, laughing and joking. And it was kind of the point of it was to establish their chemistry. Let's get these two leaders in a room and let's hope they get on, because don't forget, Donald Trump really liked Boris Johnson, or at least outwardly he did. He was very complimentary about him. And Boris Johnson usually had Donald Trump's back, even when you'd be surprised that anyone could. So there was that feeling of, oh my God, are Joe Biden and Boris Johnson not really going to click, because Donald Trump and Joe Biden are such opposite figures and they hate each other, right? But from the outset, it looked like they really did get on. I mean, who's better at pretending that they're getting on than a politician? But it did seem relatively authentic. Biden even made a joke about them both having punched above their weight in terms of who they married.
Thrilled to meet your wife.
Yes, and they've gone off to do something else.
They did. I told the Prime Minister we have something in common. We both married way above our station.
Okay, I'm not going to dissent from that one.
So there you go, that was the quote. We both married above our station. Very nice, very jovial, kind of respectful of the women as well, which is a step from the last president, dare I say. And then on to business. So the two of them, again, this is in their independent UK-US talks, they re-established our quote-unquote special relationship, which is this term, this phrase that was hammered in by Winston Churchill in World War II. And it's remained ever since, this special relationship. It's the kind of political equivalent of the two nations saying, you know what, no matter what, I've always got your back. And if you look at history of the wars we've fought, especially, it's kind of true. We've often supported each other. World War I, World War II, the Cold War, the Gulf War, and famously, Tony Blair joined George W. Bush in the war on terror, as they coined it, by entering Iraq, very controversially. So some might even say that that special relationship is a bit too special at times. And it's interesting, actually, about the special relationship thing, the word on the street in Carbis Bay, which is where the summit was held in Cornwall, was actually that Boris Johnson really doesn't like this term, special relationship. He thinks it's, apparently, allegedly, he thinks it's a bit needy. And it sounds a bit like, you know, we're a bit desperado and we want America to be our number one pal, but America's the big boss and we'll just do their bidding. What was that phrase that everyone used to say, that the UK is the US's poodle dog? I think Boris Johnson worries about that image a little bit. And so Laura Koonsberg of the BBC asked him about that.
It's a relationship. You call it the deep and meaningful relationship, whatever you want, the indestructible relationship. It's a relationship that has endured for a very long time. I don't mind the phrase special relationship, but because it is special, and it encompasses a reality, which is that the UK and the US have a real congruence of views on some stuff that really matters to the world.
So there you go, Boris Johnson talking to Laura Koonsberg of the BBC. And he says there he supposedly doesn't mind the term special relationship, but you can kind of hear in his voice that he finds it a bit icky. And then he went on to call it the, quote, indestructible relationship. Oh my God, much more macho, not needy. It's not got that needy vibe. In fact, it's totally opposite, isn't it? And what's interesting about that word indestructible is it gives us more margin to piss each other off. Do you not think? If something's indestructible, that means you can pummel it to within an inch of its life and it won't break. So he's gone for that word. I think that's interesting. Does that mean that Boris Johnson is planning to do things that might rub Joe Biden up the wrong way? And we'll talk about that a second, because there was a little bit of tension over Brexit. But either way, Joe Biden definitely reaffirmed the specialness of the relationship on Thursday. Have a listen to this.
80 years ago, Prime Minister Winston Churchill and President Franklin Roosevelt signed an agreement known as the Atlantic Charter. It was a statement of first principles, a promise that the United Kingdom and the United States would meet the challenges of their age and they would meet it together. Today, we build on that commitment with a revitalized Atlantic Charter, updated to reaffirm that promise while speaking directly to the key challenges of this century: cybersecurity, emerging technologies, global health, and climate change.
There we go. So he revitalized the Atlantic Charter, this agreement between the US and the UK, and he wanted to update it to deal with the challenges of modern times while keeping our relationship super strong. And I mentioned it just before, but the indestructible relationship was indeed tested this weekend by Brexit. Of all things, Brexit, man. It's the ex-boyfriend that won't leave you alone. You go to Cornwall to hang out with America. It's all very exciting. And there he comes round the corner on his shitty little BMX bike, you know, demanding your attention. And so much for get Brexit done. I mean, that was the concept, wasn't it? That was what everyone voted for in 2019. And here we are still being plagued by this issue months after we've signed the thing. And we, you know, both sides were supposedly happy at the time, but here we are so soon after, and it's still causing tension. And it's even rubbing America up the wrong way. So you might be wondering what went on and why it caused tension. And the bottom line is it was down to the element of Brexit that's about Northern Ireland. That's the bit that's causing the issues. So the bit of Brexit that talks about Northern Ireland is called the Northern Ireland Protocol. I've run through it in the past, but just if you've missed that, I'll explain it now. And in my notes, it says in bold, explain the protocol to the listeners. I like to fuck myself over when I'm preparing for these podcasts because it's not the easiest thing to explain. Thank you, previous Julia. But essentially, the Northern Ireland Protocol is the steps that they took in the Brexit negotiations to try and avoid at all costs a hard border from cropping up on the island of Ireland. That is bottom line, we can't have that. So what should we do to avoid that? Because at the end of the day, the Republic of Ireland is still an EU member state. They will still be abiding by all the same rules as the EU, especially on things like customs, on products. But Northern Ireland will be part of the UK. So if we've got a product going from Northern Ireland into the Republic of Ireland, how do we get around that? Because the EU are going to want to check that product to make sure it abides by all their rules, and vice versa, frankly. So what are we going to do? Well, the Northern Ireland Protocol says, why don't we, instead of having things checked on the island of Ireland, at the border between the two places? Why don't we check things in between the rest of the UK and Northern Ireland? So if it's on its way, say there's a product and it's on its way from Wales to Northern Ireland, for example, or Scotland to Northern Ireland, let's check it basically in the sea before it arrives. And then if it meets EU standards, fine, it can travel around the island of Ireland freely. It doesn't matter that there's no border. And if it doesn't, then sadly, we'll probably have to send it back. Is it perfect? No. I mean, there's people in Northern Ireland particularly who are heavy unionists, which means they really value the sanctity of the United Kingdom and the nation that is Northern Ireland being an integral part of the UK. And as soon as something like this comes in, it separates Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK, because Northern Ireland is now basically having to abide by EU rules when it comes to products and customs and things. So there's people who hate it, but it was what they came up with because they saw it as the lesser of two evils. At least this way, we're not going to have a hard border on the island of Ireland. That's the Northern Ireland Protocol in a nutshell. So there you go, previous Julia. I explained it to the listeners. And the fact of the matter is there is a grace period on this protocol. So actually, it's not going to completely kick in until the end of June. But that is fast approaching. And that, of course, then was on the minds of everybody at the G7. Oh my God, this grace period is going to end at the end of June. How is this going to go down? And frankly, it's not going to go down great. Why? Well, in a word, sausages. That's why. Basically, chilled meats. I know you're thinking, what the fuck? Chilled meats, like sausages, like chicken nuggets, like mince. Those things that are products from the UK now will not pass EU customs freely. They will need to be checked and probably sent back because they won't meet their requirements, right? Chilled meats just happens to be one product particularly that just isn't matching up with the EU's rules. And therefore, what's happening already, but what's going to happen a lot more as of the end of this grace period, is we're going to see things like sausage rolls, chicken nuggets, mincemeat being batted away from the Northern Irish border. So in between Scotland, England and Wales, it's going to stop being allowed into Northern Ireland. And that is pissing off Northern Ireland, but also the UK government. Because their argument is, okay, yes, we know we agreed to this protocol, but you can't just stop us from trading whole categories of stuff just so that we have to abide by your rules. It's not fair, particularly on Northern Ireland, because they're being stopped from getting a hold of these products. So can you exercise a bit of goodwill, please, and stop checking so much? And the EU's argument is, no, you signed... In fact, you co-wrote and then signed this plan. It takes two to tango. You pretended you were happy with it back in December. And basically what this says is that you're just going to sign things and then completely renege on them as soon as they don't suit you anymore. And by the way, how much we want to check stuff is our choice. You're not a member of the EU anymore. You can't tell us when we can check things and how often we can check things. So get fucked. We still want to protect what comes into the Republic of Ireland, because that is an EU member state. This Northern Ireland Protocol was what we came up with to do that, so we're doing it. So it's just this horrific tension that's all cropped up literally over sausages. People are calling it the sausage wars, which is a bit reductive because it's genuinely causing tension, particularly in Northern Ireland. And the BBC's Laura Koonsberg grilled Boris Johnson on what looked like a lovely beach in Cornwall about this very issue. And this is what he said.
I think it's very important that we keep the balance and symmetry of the Good Friday Agreement and make sure, and you will appreciate.
But I'm asking you about sticking to the protocol.
You will appreciate.
Sticking to the deal that you did with the European Union.
You will understand that there are ways of enforcing the protocol, ways of making it work may be excessively burdensome. Let me just give you one statistic. 20% of the checks conducted by across the whole of the perimeter of the EU are now done in Northern Ireland, three times as many as happen in Rotterdam. I think we can sort it out.
You think we can sort it? You can sort it out? Do you think you can sort it out in the next few days?
I think we can sort it out.
I don't know about you, but Boris Johnson to me doesn't sound like he's going to budge on this. He's sort of talking about, nope, our primary interest is protecting the sanctity of the United Kingdom, and Northern Ireland is very much a part of that. And actually, at this G7 summit, what inflamed tensions, in fact, seriously inflamed tensions of this so-called sausage row, sausage war, was when allegedly the French president, so Emmanuel Macron, and Boris Johnson, they were supposedly having this chat. And Boris Johnson, in this conversation, was trying to reason with Emmanuel Macron about this sausage thing. So the story goes that Boris Johnson was saying to Emmanuel Macron, come on, surely you can see where I'm coming from with this. How would you feel if we said, right, you're not allowed to send sausages between Toulouse and Paris? And in response, again, word of mouth thing, but apparently Emmanuel Macron turned around to Boris Johnson and said, that's not an appropriate example. Using Toulouse and Paris isn't the same because they're both part of France and Northern Ireland isn't part of the UK. Cue much gasp and bemusement and dismay, because having a French president say, oh, Northern Ireland isn't part of the UK, that is not good, because Northern Ireland is part of the UK. And this kind of caused UK leaders to go, oh, wow, now your true colours are coming out. So all this time that we've been arguing about Brexit and we've been hitting brick walls about Northern Ireland, it's because you haven't respected the fact that Northern Ireland is indeed part of the UK. So no wonder you're pushing it with these constant checks at the Northern Irish border, because you don't respect that it's part of the UK. You're not showing goodwill about that concept. And in fact, Dominic Raab made matters worse when so Dominic Raab is the UK's foreign secretary. So it's kind of his job to like make sure that we're cool with all these other nations. And he did not do that when he spoke to Andrew Marr. And he said that Emmanuel Macron's comments were, quote, offensive.
What did you personally feel when you heard those comments?
Well, it's not new to me. I've been Brexit secretary, I've been foreign secretary for a while now. I think it shows that there's still a failure to appreciate what that level of misunderstanding, I think that's the polite way of putting it, of the situation in Northern Ireland, and can have. And it has real repercussions on the ground.
Is it
for
offensive?
The communities there. Yeah, I think it is offensive. We wouldn't dream of talking about those areas in those terms. What we want is a bit of respect from the other side, a bit of flexibility, a bit of goodwill.
Okay.
Dominic Raab there on Andrew Marr, not particularly helping to ease the tensions between the EU and the UK during the G7 summit. Again, all about this Northern Ireland protocol thing. And you might be thinking, right, okay, classic, we're not getting on with France about Brexit. Tell me something else that's new. But what's this got to do with the USA? Why is this getting Joe Biden's backup? A couple of things. Firstly, on a personal level, Joe Biden has really strong Irish roots that he talks about all the time, constantly. What is that about Americans, by the way? You know how you meet Americans and they say, well, I'm actually Irish-American, or I'm an Italian-American? And it could be like 19 generations ago. It's nice, it's flattering, but it's kind of interesting. But he is one of those Americans that very regularly does that. And so, just on a personal level, he is invested in making sure that there aren't tensions in Ireland. But also there's the fact that, of course, the USA is invested in ensuring that the Good Friday Agreement remains intact. The Good Friday Agreement, of course, is the peace deal brokered between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. But it was overseen by the UK and, very importantly, the USA. In fact, it was an American senator who chaired that peace deal brokerage, I'm pretty sure. Let me check now, because I'm doubting myself. Yeah, Senator George J. Mitchell, the Belfast Agreement signed in 1998. Yeah, Senator George J. Mitchell, American senator that chaired that. So the US has a vested interest in that. And Biden is looking at this fucking sausage row and saying, guys, look at the bigger picture. Please, please don't fall out about this. There's already been violence erupting in pockets of Northern Ireland. This has been fueled by Brexit tensions. Can you two please knock your heads together and compromise? Because this stubbornness on both sides, but to be honest, particularly on the side of the UK, because we're the ones that signed the thing and we're now going back on it. Can you guys please just not make matters worse with this stubbornness? And think about it from Joe Biden's position as well. If you're him, he's taken on the role of presidency during a global pandemic. He sees China and Russia and these kind of autocratic, which means not democratic, autocratic states, that he sees them as a big threat, not to mention the climate crisis. The last thing he needs is two of his biggest allies, arguably his two biggest allies, the EU and the UK, falling out. And it's not falling out a little bit. It's seriously falling out. This is a trade agreement that we've made. It's one of the biggest international treaties in the history of our time. And we are already sacking it off 6 months after we signed the thing. So Joe Biden, of course, is like annoyed about that. And the whole thing, you know, this Northern Ireland Protocol, it's a political minefield. I reckon at this point, I don't like being a pessimist, especially on this podcast. I don't want it to be like that, but I'm just going to rant for a second. I think either way, it's a bit of a lose-lose. If the UK, in terms of us, if we stay as stubborn as we've been and we just get deeper and deeper into our trench of, we know we signed it, but stop being dicks about it, stop checking so many of our sausages. If we stay in that trench, it's just going to make tensions worse. I don't think the EU are particularly up for compromising because they've already spent, as Macron described it, thousands of hours negotiating with us. They finally got landed on something, we signed it, and now we're annoyed about it. So I don't think the EU are going to move. If we stay put, it's just going to make it worse. If we bend, and if we say, okay, sorry for kicking off, we will abide by this Northern Ireland Protocol, then Northern Irish leaders and unionists are going to be on Boris Johnson's case saying, oh, great, okay, so just to keep the peace with the EU, you've essentially sold Northern Ireland down the river. We are now completely stuck abiding by their rules. We can't even get certain products from you guys without them being sent back. So basically, we aren't part of the UK in many ways. You don't respect the fact that we are part of the UK. That's not fair. So if we bend, then he's got that. But if we rebel against the Northern Ireland Protocol, and if we go further than where we've been going so far, and we completely pull it, if we enact Article 16, which means if we pull it, then you're going to have A, the EU saying, right, you guys suck, you agreed to this, and now you can't be bothered with it. That'll teach us to ever make an agreement with you bastards again, because you clearly don't respect the agreements that you make. Plus, we'll have the US watching on, going, right, that's really annoying that you've done that. You've made tensions worse when we specifically asked you not to. Plus, remember this, why did we do Brexit in the first place? It was so that we could have other trade agreements, wasn't it? It was so that we could have other opportunities with other big states. The US being the big juicy fish that we wanted, right? If the US watches us sack off an agreement we made with the EU, how confident are they going to be in writing up their own trade agreements with us? Why would Joe Biden ever want to do that? Because we've shown that we don't have any respect for the stuff that we sign. Boris Johnson wouldn't say that. He would say, well, come on, the EU and the UK signed it under a guise of goodwill, and the EU are taking advantage of that. So there's lots of perspectives on this, but I do think that if we rebel completely, then it doesn't make us look like particularly honest, agreeable deal makers. So like I say, I'm sorry for that rant, but I think it's a lose-lose. I think this whole Northern Ireland Protocol thing, it was all too good to be true when they signed it. I knew there would be consequences, and here we are. But I guess we'll see what happens at the end of this grace period. Right, I think that's quite enough about Brexit. Truly, I've truly had enough. The word makes me gag at this point, and I think we are going to be stuck dealing with it for a long time. But shut up, Julia. I'm not talking about Brexit anymore. There are lots of other things on the table at the G7 meeting. First and foremost, of course, was the pandemic. And one sort of record-breaking thing that came out of the G7 summit was a joint pledge to roll out 1 billion vaccines to developing countries, so to poorer countries. And of that 1 billion, if you split it up, America is set to donate 500 million, or roundabout, so half. And then the UK is set to donate around 100 million.
This summit was the first gathering of G7 leaders, in fact, the first gathering of pretty much any leaders in almost 2 years. And I know that the world was looking to us to reject some of the selfishness and nationalistic approaches that have marred the initial global response to the pandemic. I'm very pleased to announce that this weekend leaders have pledged over 1 billion doses, either directly or through funding to COVAX. That includes 100 million from the UK to the world's poorest countries, which is another big step towards vaccinating the world.
So there you go, Boris Johnson saying that this is an effort to reject the, quote, selfish and nationalistic approaches that have marred the initial response to the pandemic. Yeah, selfish and nationalistic. That's how I would describe it. I'm quite glad that he was sort of self-aware enough to acknowledge that. Because let's not beat around the bush. What happened initially when this pandemic first broke out, and specifically when the vaccines were approved, wealthy nations were elbowing the shit out of each other to get a hold of more vaccines than anyone else. They were just worried about how many can I get over them, and not a second thought was given to poorer countries who couldn't even afford to get in the queue to buy some, let alone push to the front of that queue. There were even instances of wealthy nations physically blocking vaccines from leaving their borders to be shipped to other countries who had actually paid for them. I mean, if that's not vaccine nationalism, I don't know what is. And it's common knowledge now that the UK has enough jabs to vaccinate its population twice over. We've literally got double the amount of vaccine doses that we need. In a pandemic, this behaviour is senseless. Because it's a pandemic, what's a pandemic? It's a global outbreak of a disease. So we are not in the clear until everyone in the world is in the clear. That's just common sense. So while our vaccine rollout, you know, rages on, and we're asking for praise for how fantastic we're doing, it doesn't make sense, because we are literally stuck on this island until we can do more to help get rid of the virus on a global level. Sorry, I didn't mean to end up ranting about that. But it's good. What I'm saying is, it's good that Boris Johnson said, yeah, at the outset, we were selfish and nationalistic. Let's try to rectify that. So how are they doing that? 1 billion vaccines donated by the G7 nations collectively. And from the outset, it's a record breaker. Nothing like that's been done before. But there's questions. How is it going to be done? By when is that going to be done? Because the timeline is not immediate. So the UK is actually only going to get 5 million of those out by September, by the end of September. 30 million in total by the end of the year. And then we'll have that remaining 70 million by the end of next year rolled out to poorer countries. So by the end of 2022. And this isn't enough vaccines for the whole world. This is just some of the vaccines that are needed. And even they are not going to be out there until the end of next year. So yes, it's a big promise from the outset. Yes, it breaks global medical records. Will it eradicate the virus? No. It'll certainly help. But naturally, many critics are saying it is just not enough. And the big thing that Boris Johnson's critics are pointing to is this unwillingness he's shown to completely waive the patents of the vaccines. So the recipes, if you like, and actually give those recipes to poorer countries, so that instead of just donating them and buying them for them, we could just say, right, make them. You know, here's the facilities to make them, off you go. And that saves everybody on shipping and logistics and all of the rest of it. And Boris Johnson is taking a stance there, because the US is fine with the idea of waiving patents. Not forever, just temporarily until we get out the end of this pandemic. But as far back as a month ago, Joe Biden showed support for that idea. And yet Boris Johnson, and it's not just Boris Johnson, actually, Germany's Angela Merkel, the outgoing leader of Germany, she doesn't like the idea either. So both of them have said, nah, we're not waiving patents. That's a hard pass, with Boris Johnson saying we need to keep them a secret to, quote, protect the incentives for innovation. Incentives for innovation as a priority over stopping of global pandemic. That sounds to me nationalist-y, vaccine-y, hoardy. It's a pandemic. We are suffering as a consequence when everyone else is still spreading this thing and new variants are popping up every month or so. But we don't want to give away our secret recipe because it's good for us business-wise. I don't know if that matches up. Maybe I'm being too simplistic about it. Let me know what you think. Okay, finally, let's talk about the climate. And I said at the beginning, first off, I just expected to hear and see a lot more on this. I thought it was distinctly absent from most if not all, headlines for the entirety of the summit. You didn't stop hearing about the fucking sausage war, but it was very sparse on this, which isn't ideal because the climate is, at the end of the day, the most pressing issue alongside the pandemic. And once we've got out the other end of the pandemic, if we wait till then, which might be 2, 3, 4 years, it will be too late to address the climate, because really we've only got about 10 years to fully reverse the direction that we're going in and get everyone on the same page. We've got 10 years. So I was expecting this to be the crunch time where they go, right, what are we doing about this? Because we need to make these pledges now so it's done by 2030. Anyway, what was actually said? Pledges. Pledges were said. Not a huge amount of concrete commitment. Very few actual timelines. But number one was a commitment to phase out coal. That was the big focus. Coal is this really dirty fossil fuel. It's, you know, the process of digging it up and burning it, it's all terrible to the environment. Let's move to cleaner energy sources. That was a big focus. And part of that wasn't just let's phase out coal in our own countries within the G7. It was let's throw money at poorer nations to help them phase out coal as well. Because they're developing and they need coal to build their economies. We're the ones, the G7 countries are the ones that fucked up the climate. We're the ones that have already built our utopia off the back of these fossil fuels. But we've got to try and convince the poorer nations who haven't had that luxury to go green before they've fully developed. How are we going to do that? Definitely going to have to throw money at the issue. The number of $100 billion was mentioned. So collectively, let's throw $100 billion at poorer nations, try to convince them away from coal. But bear in mind, that number, $100 billion, was promised back in 2009. That was when they had a similar summit in 2009. They agreed on that. Let's have this achieved by 2020. And spoiler alert, they didn't. They didn't meet that. Although they'll blame that on the pandemic. But still, hearing that now didn't feel anyone with a huge amount of confidence that they're going to meet that goal again. So there you go. That's one thing, commitment to phasing out coal. The second thing was this concept of a green revolution. So the term they coined was let's build back after the pandemic, but let's build back better and greener. So let's invest in new jobs and a new economy all around the green industry. So like, you know, investing in new sources of power like wind and solar, funding scientific innovation in those industries, which creates jobs, etc., etc. You've heard it all before. Was it enough? Are you going to be shocked to hear that basically every single climate activist would say no? Of course it wasn't enough. So Kirsty McNeil from Crack the Crises said the G7 summit was, quote, a historic missed opportunity on climate change. And then she said that the leaders came with good intentions, but, quote, without their checkbooks. So not enough money, not enough concrete plans. Although it is probably worth saying that I can't remember a single time ever that a G7 summit has happened, or indeed any kind of international leaders meeting, where activists have said, yes, what they pledged is precisely what what we wanted, what we asked for, and what we need. It doesn't happen. Not that that's an excuse, and not that I think that they've done enough. They haven't. I don't think climate was enough of a talking point. I don't think that they showed how this is the number one thing, because it literally is. I don't think they did. But climate activists are saying even more so, they're really cross about what happened. And also there's the element of, it's not just did they do enough, it's will they even be able to commit to what they promised? Like even this stuff that they have promised, like let's turn away from coal. Joe Biden now has to go back to America and get that idea passed through Congress. That's not easy. It's hard to get things passed through Congress, especially on environmental stuff. The entire American economy is very reliant on fossil fuels. It's a huge motor industry. Like, roads is their thing. How many people go to America and talk about, oh, I've travelled around the whole place by train? It's not a thing. So there's this kind of huge split of priorities where people are saying, yes, the environment is important, but can't really kill a whole economy in pursuit of that. Because there's people relying on lorries and trucks, and we can't just convince everyone to go hybrid within the next few years. We are powered still by fossil fuels, so we're not that willing to hurt people in the pursuit of the climate, and Joe Biden has a lot to contend with. It's not just Joe Biden, Japan as well. Japanese leader has to go back and convince, you know, his parliament or the equivalent to agree to this. So they've got to get over those hurdles, because a big part of this pledge is going to be about convincing poorer nations to get on board as well. And if they can't even get their own countries across the line, how are they going to convince the likes of India and Brazil to take the same approach, to take the green approach? I'm also thinking ahead to this COP26 summit in Glasgow. How fun that it's going to be in Glasgow, by the way. I think I'm just biased because my family is all from Glasgow. If you follow me on Instagram, you'll have heard particularly my dad features prominently. And that, you know, it's a cool thing for Glasgow to be put so heavily on the map about this. If you don't know what COP26 is, it's basically the United Nations Climate Summit. And it's called COP26 because it is the Conference of the Parties of the United Nations. So that's COP of the United Nations. And 26 because it's the 26th year it's happening. And like I say, it's happening in Glasgow in November. And I'm just thinking ahead to that because the G7 members who, let's not forget, are the richest democracies in the world, basically. They're going to be tasked with going to this thing and saying, look at all the stuff we did back in June in Cornwall. Didn't we do well? Now can you get on board with it? Can you commit to the same goals that we have? And these poorer countries, I think there's a big risk of them saying, well, this is all a bit fucking rich, frankly, because you want us to help you with this global problem that is the climate crisis. Where were you when we had the global problem of a fucking pandemic? You know, when the vaccines were approved, I was talking about it just before, all the wealthy democracies were elbowing each other out of the way to get their fill their boots with them. And it took a long time for them to think, oh shit, we need to send these out to poor countries. And yet you come on here, holier than thou, saying you are the climate saviours, even though you are the ones that fucked up the climate in the first place. And now you want us to sign up, even though you were absent with your help on vaccines until arguably it was too late. I think that's a risk. I don't know if they'll be as sassy as that, and I don't think the language will be as fruity, but I wonder if that might be the message. So I think, weirdly, this vaccine rollout, you know, giving 1 billion vaccines to the poorer countries, it's directly connected to climate change. One relies on the other. And I think it's very important that we get every vaccine out that we've promised ahead of November, preferably more, so that at least we can say, well, we're helping now. And I, especially about Boris Johnson, I hope he has some very valid answers prepared up his sleeve for if and when he is asked by these poorer countries, why haven't you waived the patents on the recipes of these vaccines? Why are you doing that? Why are you holding on to that? Because I imagine that, you know, a lot of the people at the COP26 would have been direct beneficiaries of that, and he's squandered their chances by holding on to those secrets. So I hope he's got some valid answers prepared, and I hope they're convincing. I know that he can be charming. I know that a lot of you are going to hate me saying that. He can be. Let's fucking hope he is, because the climate relies on it. Isn't it mad? International politics is this sort of wild west where states use these ridiculously big poker chips to trade with. Oh, you spend $1 billion on that and I won't invade that country. And if you help me with this, then I'll send you vaccines for that disease. It's so nuts that really there's only a few key individuals who are responsible for having this scale of conversation and this scale of like bartering trade, which essentially affects all of us. We're just relying on these few people that we voted on a few years ago and hope that they do the best. I mean, and also, so much of it relies on chemistry. It's not even about what bartering chips they use. It's, do these people fundamentally get on? Does Boris Johnson make Joe Biden laugh enough? It seems silly when you see photo ops of, like, the leaders and their wives running along the beach, but is it silly, or is it really important that we hope that their chemistry is good? Because at the end of the day, global warming, getting out the end of this pandemic, our relationship with China, our relationship with trading with other nations relies on these people's chemistry. I mean, if you think about it for too long, it will put you in a bad mood, I think, is the key takeaway from that point. So, long podcast episode, but that is a bit of a summary of the G7. A lot of you, I said at the beginning, asked me, why is this a big deal? Is it just phony? Is it just a photo op? Or will we see actionable change? Yes, I think they have. They've made actionable commitments. They've got the big one, I think, is this 1 billion vaccines. That's a number that they have dedicated to, and they're already on the move trying to get those out. Is the timeline quick enough? That's up to you to decide. Should we be expected to do more? Or are you kind of saying, well, it is a pandemic. We are still trying to, you know, we should put the oxygen mask on ourselves before we put that on other countries. Maybe that's your viewpoint. But I do think the 1 billion vaccines is something to take away from this. Oh, do you know, another thing I didn't mention was this approach to women and girls in developing countries. So that was actually a focus, was gender development. And who's going to argue with that? Idiots would argue with that. In fact, I'm not even going to open up the floor to that because someone's going to say something sexist and annoying. But yeah, so this pledge is that was agreed at the G7 is to get 40 million more girls into education by 2026. Not going to argue with that. The fact that it was a focus is great. And it's an obvious approach. You know, let's not squander half the global population. The more girls are in education, the better it's going to be for everybody. So that was an interesting thing that came out of it. But I think as well, another sort of actionable thing that comes from the G7 is Joe Biden's place on the international stage. What's his message? What's his goal? And I think he really wanted to use this summit as a chance to say, right, I'm here. Hello. I'm here with my Ray-Ban aviator sunglasses. This is the end of the Donald Trump era, and it's the start of mine. And let me tell you, the two things could not be further apart.
The only way we're going to meet the global threats that we're is by working together and with our partners and our allies. And I conveyed to each of my G7 counterparts that the United States is going to do our part. America is back at the table.
Back at the table. That's what he said about America on the international stage. And that will be particularly talking about the climate, because let's remember, Donald Trump showed, it was mixed messages from Donald Trump, but most of the time it was disdain, if not indifference to the climate. And he even pulled the US out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which is the kind of predecessor to all these climate agreements that we have, including this COP26 in Glasgow. The Paris Agreement is this concept of let's make commitments to stop global warming, and Trump pulled out of it. So Biden, especially on that front, I think, is saying it's the end of that era. It's the start of mine. And incidentally, Biden wasn't just coming to Cornwall. He is on a tour. I can check up where he's at now. I know he's meeting up with Vladimir Putin in, I believe, Geneva. Yeah, so he went from the UK to Belgium, to Brussels, and then on to Switzerland. And it's now, what's the date today? The 16th of June. So he's in Switzerland in Geneva. And this is his chance to attend this summit meeting with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. That will be an interesting conversation because Donald Trump was quite mixed about his relationship with Russia. He didn't portray them as like the villain per se. He even wanted to cozy up with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. He had this weird fascination with these sort of global dictatorial figures, dictators. He wanted to show that he had this sort of strongman ability to negotiate with them, or at least to be friendly with them. Joe Biden is a bit more straight-laced with his narrative. He's like, nah, these are the bad guys. We're the good guys. They're a threat. So I'm interested to see how that dynamic goes. Obviously, it's the first time the meeting in person since Joe Biden is the president. But still, I think that's the G7 pretty much covered. Let me know your thoughts. What do you think? Was it all worth it? Do you think that they came out with enough, or are you disappointed? Are you impressed that it wasn't just photo ops and there do seem to be actionable plans? Get in touch with me on social media at JuliaBell_X. If you like these podcast episodes and you find them helpful, the only way to keep me going, because I do them on my own, the only way to keep me able to make them is if you become a patron. If you've been thinking about it for a while and you haven't done it, please, I'm going to ask you kindly, do it today. The link is in the episode description, and you can just see it there. It'll say visit my Patreon page. You can click the link and there's a ton of bonus content on there for you to enjoy as well. And listen, happy Pride Month. I haven't said that yet, which is outrageous. So much love, all the love in the world to any LGBTQ+ listeners. If you're listening in England and probably the rest of the UK, I am sorry that our dates for opening up have officially been pushed back to the 12th of July, if you're listening in England, I believe. Let me just check. The 19th of July, excuse me. 19th of July, at least. But Boris Johnson is pretty confident that by then we'll be ahead of this vaccine rollout, and hopefully we can all go fucking clubbing because I'm desperate to do that. And that's it. I hope you're getting a chance to get out in the sunshine. I will be editing this episode on a train in 30 degree heat. So a moment of thought for me in that position, please. But I think I'm going to buy a cheeky rosé and pop it in my bag so I can crack that out when the train conductor's not looking. that's my little nugget of hope for today. Thank you for listening. You guys are the best. Thank you for your questions. It helps kind of give some shape to what I talk to you about, and it really does help. And I will surely speak to you in the next one. Okay, goodbye.